Case number 13-3044, United States of America v. Simon A. Dillon, Appellant. Mr. Davis for the appellant, Mr. Goodhand for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Davis, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Simon Dillon. The issue I would like to discuss with the court this morning is whether the district court erred in failing to take into consideration the level of dangerousness as a proper component of a cell analysis when issuing its order to have the appellant, Simon Dillon, involuntarily medicated. It is our position that dangerousness is a critical factor to look at with individuals that present as appellant does. Mental illness is too complex to curtail a consideration of all of the afflicted individual's particular facts.
But if he's not dangerous, which I think is your point here, doesn't that mean civil commitment is less likely, which actually cuts against your position under cell?
Well, actually, the appellant, based on the record below, there was a finding of dangerousness, and this topic was bantered back and forth at the district court level.
But your point is, well, you tell me what your point is about the dangerousness of your client.
My point is that we were cut off at the district court level from inquiring into any level of dangerousness whatsoever, and it is our position that Mr. Dillon's level of dangerousness is a proper consideration. There was evidence before the district.
But how does it work? This may be a tension in cell in the case, but it seems, or the case law, it seems like if there is dangerousness, that's going to go into the Harper box in any event. If there's not dangerousness, and I'm just bifurcating here, if there's not dangerousness, then the likelihood of civil commitment is not there, and actually, therefore, that factor does not help you under cell.
Well, look, taking a look at the facts as they are in this case, first of all, the appellant, there had been a Harper finding that he was not dangerous to himself or others while confined.
Exactly.
Now, that is an elimination test. That is a test that the Supreme Court in cells indicated would eliminate the need for a cell analysis. Mm-hmm. It's our position that though it eliminates the need for a cell analysis, it doesn't foreclose a consideration of any level of dangerousness. And we believe that this is adequately demonstrated by the cell court's consideration and identification of a special circumstance of long-term civil commitment. Long-term civil commitment being a special circumstance that would undercut the government's interest in prosecuting the individual. So it's our position that Harper does not foreclose any consideration of the level of dangerousness.
But is it your position that cell requires that dangerousness be taken into account? Because as I read cell, it presupposes that the individual was not dangerous, but then it goes on to prescribe the cell inquiry that could result in
I think the operative word to focus on here when we're looking at this is this level of dangerousness. And Mr. Dillon's, the appellant Dillon's case is a very good case to demonstrate this. Because what we have with with the appellant Dillon is we have a civil finding that he is dangerous. We have a civil finding by the D.C. Mental Health Commission before we even got to the district court that he was dangerous. He was committed by law to an outpatient treatment facility. Now, he was beginning the process to come into the Superior Court to litigate that, but that finding had been made. So there is already a finding that this man is dangerous. The question is what is his level of dangerousness? Now, Harper and Riggins, those cases, in particular Harper, if someone is so dangerous to themselves or others, you can bypass the need to go to a cell analysis because you can depend on the procedural safeguards from within the institution to medicate the individual. Mr. Dillon didn't meet that criteria, so he moved on to the cell analysis. Our position is that you have to take this into consideration when evaluating the government's interest in prosecuting someone. And Sell supports that by identifying the fact that if someone is civilly committed, that is a special circumstance to take into consideration.
So what's the end result in this case?
Well, the end result is that there was no...
Your client is freed?
Well, he's not going to be freed under any circumstances. I would
play out for me how this would go under your theory.
We would go back to the district court and we'd have an inquiry into the level of dangerousness.
Assume you won on that.
Assume I won and he was not forcibly medicated. Mm-hmm. My assumption would be that the United States would move to civilly commit him, either to continue the proceedings that are held in abeyance now in the District of Columbia, or begin their own process to have him civilly committed. But we can't even look at these factors. And
but
we can't,
you would argue that he's not subject to civil commitment, and therefore he's freed, right?
Well, I'm certain Mr. Dillon's position would be that he is not eligible for civil commitment, but that would be the process that would be necessary to go through. And there has already been a determination that he is dangerous to some extent. It's just that we haven't flushed out the level of dangerousness that he presents. And it's an important factor to take into consideration. When we consider that someone is going to be involuntarily medicated, it is probably the most egregious infringement upon one's liberty interest. I mean, you're not just taking someone and incarcerating them. You're not just telling someone they can't do something that they want to do. You are changing how they perceive the world. And as Mr. Dillon's testimony indicated at the trial level, which I submit did not receive much consideration from anyone at all, his testimony, his exact words were, when I was medicated, and these are the exact same medications that he is going to be subjected to if this order is upheld. He indicated that they literally sucked the life out of him. He had no will to live. He became suicidal. I believe in the joint appendix there is a discharge summary from one of the hospitalizations where he became suicidal after ingesting these medications.
I guess the district court said there that the evidence showed that was from the underlying condition and not from the treatment itself.
Which is interesting. I believe that was the testimony of the expert, Dr.
Right.
Volan, the psychiatrist from Butner. What is interesting about that is that Mr. Dillon really didn't historically present much, if any, evidence of being suicidal in the past, nor of being depressed. Those symptoms surfaced after he had been medicated for a certain period of time. So the logical conclusion from that situation is either A, the medications were not working, and therefore it's not substantially likely that he's going to be restored to competency, or it's not substantially likely he's going to be able to assist counsel at trial, because if he's suicidal and he's depressed and he's having command hallucinations to kill himself, he's certainly not going to be of much assistance at trial. Either the medications work, in which case those symptoms wouldn't show, or they're not working, in which case there isn't a substantial likelihood he's going to be restored to competency. So I just don't see how that supports the court's decision to order him to be to involuntarily submit to medication.
You don't think the district court plainly erred in failing to consider the likelihood of civil commitment?
We didn't even get to that.
I said plainly erred. The Supreme Court says it's a consideration.
Yes. Yes.
And I looked at the record here and said, this court just plainly erred. This court declined to do it.
And
you're obliged to do it. Especially after, you know, you just preached on what a serious infringement, this personal infringement, this would be. Doesn't that suggest that you would be urging that the district court cannot possibly fail to consider the likelihood of civil commitment and weighing whether or not to intrude one's person?
That is where the argument would have gone if we had been allowed to develop the dangerousness issue. but being foreclosed from considering.
I'm not completely understanding your responses to Judge Kavanaugh. Your conjoining the dangerousness and the civil commitment. You are focusing strictly on the dangerousness.
And the reason.
Not on the failure to consider the likelihood of civil commitment.
The reason I am focusing on the dangerousness is the two concepts are intricately intertwined. You have to have a level of dangerousness to make a reasonable and competent assessment of whether anyone is going to be civilly committed. In this instance, we do have a determination that this man has been civilly committed. What we were shut down from doing is addressing exactly what Your Honor has raised. Should the court have considered that he would have been civilly committed for a lengthy period? I couldn't.
Now.
I have.
No, that has not been your focus. And the district court's failure to consider the fact of potential civil commitment has not been your focus.
It was argued back and forth. The United States.
Before us, before this court.
Well, at the trial court level.
At this court.
No,
I'm saying, why isn't it your focus before us, this court?
Well, because he is civilly committed. I mean, he is civilly committed. Okay. I can't address how long he will be committed. I can't make an argument that he's going to be civilly committed for a lengthy period of time because we have not been allowed to develop the record on the issue of dangerousness. So for me to argue that he's going to be committed for a lengthy period of time, I would have to speculate on what his level of dangerousness is, and we need to develop
just
the record.
Just so I'm clear, your argument was that that your client's less dangerous or not dangerous.
Which reduces the likelihood of civil commitment.
Right.
That's why I'm perplexed by the turn in this argument. But in any event, go ahead, answer.
Perhaps the term less dangerous was a bit inartful. I believe what is the proper consideration is the level of his dangerousness, because he is not completely non-dangerous. There has been a finding by the D.C. Mental Health Commission that he is dangerous. Mm-hmm. The level of dangerousness is the important factor that I was trying to get into.
Okay, why don't we hear from the government, and we'll give you time on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court, David Goodingham for the United States. Turning first to the suggestion from defense counsel that below he was, quote, cut off from pursuing the issue of dangerousness, I would just direct the Court's attention to the joint appendix at 231. When defense counsel was arguing to the Court about what special circumstances are in play, he says, quote, he's not a dangerous person. That was the main focus of his argument below. He had two special circumstances that he drew to the Court's attention. Number one, the issue of pretrial incarceration and the issue of how that might have undermined the government's interest in prosecution. And number two, he had the argument that the Court generically should take into consideration this notion that his client was somehow not a dangerous person. And the Court, quite rightly, I think, when you look at Sell, said, I don't see how that fits into the Sell analysis, because Sell presumes a non-dangerous individual. And in fact, that's why the criteria for medication in the context of Sell is so stringent. It's a multi-factor test. The government has to prove each factor by clear and convincing evidence. They are significant burdens, quite appropriately so. And that's because Sell said, we are taking dangerousness out of the mix. We are asking whether or not the medication is necessary for the competency purpose only. And so in response to the defendant's claim he's not a dangerous person, the district court quite rightly said, well, that's Sell has already assumed that. That doesn't undermine the government's interest. As to the issue of civil commitment, the defendant never raised the issue of civil commitment as a special circumstance. Of course, that is a permissible special circumstance that the Court could have taken into consideration. But when the defendant stands up and says he's not a dangerous person, that almost automatically takes civil commitment out of the...
Someone has to make that judgment.
Well, I think
the defendant saying it I don't know whether it's self-serving or not, but the defendant saying it isn't dispositive. I mean, I understand you're trying the case that's being presented, but what I'm wondering is, isn't it plain error for the district court not to take this into account, given the nature of the case that we're talking about? That is, someone's mental competency, and there are certain factors Supreme Court said take into account, and the court ought to take them into account.
It's not plain error. Number one, what Sell says with respect to the special circumstances is that the court may consider them. And it's what Sell, as I read it, was doing was saying, look, when you're assessing the government's interest in prosecution, there are a myriad of individualized factors that you should consider when you're assessing that first prong of the analysis. And then it gave some examples, civil commitment, pretrial incarceration. They also, in the Supreme Court, Sell said, you also have to consider whether or not this is going to impinge on his fair trial right. But if there's no mandatory consideration there, it's may. And in that respect, I would suggest that when you look at the defendant's opposition to the motion for involuntary medication, you see that he focused solely on the pretrial incarceration special factor, special circumstance. Then he gets to the argument in the district court. He says he's not a dangerous person. The district court quite rightly concludes, well, he's not pushing the civil commitment as a special circumstance.
But isn't that exactly what would alert the district court to consider it if he's pushing on not a dangerous person? Because then he's precisely within the parameters of Sell.
Exactly.
And then the district court ought to, I would think, ought to, in this kind of a case, know that I've got to, in weighing the things that are clearly material here, I've got to consider the likelihood of civil commitment and what do I think about it.
Well, I think when the defendant says he's not a dangerous person, then the court, B follows from A. If I have a defendant who's telling me he's not dangerous, and I know that the standard for civil commitment is a substantial risk to self or others upon release.
Only?
I believe, yes. That's as I understand it, that's the 4246 standard for civil commitment.
So he was pushing the opposite of
exactly
what Sell would suggest as a special circumstance on this particular issue. And that's a tension inherent in the case law, but that's the point.
I think there is. I mean, I think what Sell says is, look, first, district court, there's a threshold determination you have to make. Is this man presently a danger to himself or others and or gravely disabled? If he's not, you don't meet the Harper criteria. And you move into, if the government suggests it's appropriate for prosecution, you move into the Sell criteria.
Of course, that same tension cuts in the opposite direction for you, I think, in that the more that you argue that or suggest that he is dangerous, the more you're left with the possibility that then civil commitment becomes a real issue.
Exactly. And I think that's why this court in Weston actually said, look, and actually Sell says the same thing. Sell says, look, we are suggesting that civil commitment is a special circumstance you should consider. We are not saying it's outcome determinative with respect to the government's interest.
Yeah, well, I say that with great warmth. I got abrogated on that piece of it on the civil commitment in Weston.
I mean,
the court wasn't buying as far as we went in Weston.
That actually,
the relevance of civil commitment.
As I read Sell, I actually think I may be misremembering Weston, but the second Weston decision, I think, actually quite presciently anticipates Sell, because what the second Weston decision said was, look, civil commitment is something a district court should take into consideration when weighing this significant liberty interest, but it's not outcome determinative because it only accounts for incapacitation. It doesn't account for deterrence. It doesn't account for retribution. It doesn't account for the whole notion of a public trial. And that's what exactly, as I read Sell, what they said is, in that respect, we agree. Civil commitment and the incapacitation that might follow from a lengthy detention at the back end of a 4246 process is one factor for the court to consider when weighing the government's interest, but by no stretch of the imagination is it outcome determinative on that first factor of the importance of the government interest.
Is there a possibility that there's a difference in the nature of the dangerousness inquiries? In other words, the dialogue so far has presupposed that the dangerousness in Harper is the same dangerousness that goes to civil commitment. But in Harper, what the court was talking about was dangerousness to oneself or others in an institutional setting. And for civil commitment purposes, it's dangerousness writ large.
I, I think that's exactly right. I've read Sell probably 58 times, and it uses a phrase, a semi-Harper finding. But I have seen other cases since Sell who have said, yes, of course, we understand there are two different dangerousness as findings here, as you, Your Honor, has articulated. One, I think I would suggest, is certainly a barometer of the other. That is, if you have a Harper finding that the defendant is not a danger to himself or others in the institutional setting, I think that's a pretty good barometer of whether or not he would meet the criteria for 4246, that is, danger upon release. But I don't disagree in the slightest with the suggestion that we want to make sure we don't conflate the two. And I think maybe that's why Sell brings back into the mix civil commitment as a special circumstance for consideration when you're assessing the government's interest. But I don't disagree with the notion that we have to be careful. And I think the case law supports that, at least in the federal courts of appeals that have looked at this since Sell was decided. I see my time is running short.
Your point then is that a defendant is dangerous, but not so dangerous that civil commitment would be likely, and therefore that special circumstance doesn't kick in.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, the courts, and I would point to the circuit decision in Mackey, they say if the record is ambiguous, if it's uncertain about the issue of civil commitment, that probably doesn't undermine the government's interest. I would certainly suggest that if nothing else here, we have not ambiguity with respect to civil commitment. Instead, we have a pretty clear statement from the defendant. He considers himself not a danger. So if nothing else, the record is doesn't support that special circumstance here.
So is that because in your brief, you make the argument that your opponents minimize the level of his dangerousness?
I made that as an alternative argument, as is my wont, Your Honor, because from my perspective, the defendant took a position below and argued that to the district court. I got the sense in his brief on appeal that he was taking a different position, and he was suggesting that he had been cut off from arguing this to the court. I don't think he was cut off, but I think he was taking a different position. I argued at any rate, I believe that there was obviously an inherent feature of dangerousness to the crime itself that could that would not undermine the government's interest in prosecution. That's my take on it. But that was an alternative argument because I think the court, I mean, I think it's difficult to look at this record and not understand that Judge Bates took this very seriously, as well he should. I think this is a very clean, well-supported record. Two experts from the government walked into that court, gave very detailed testimony about all of the factors, and I think the district court's decision is pristine in its analysis and its adherence to Sell. And in that respect, we would ask that you affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll give you a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. If there's any clouding of the issue at the district court level, I would ask the court to consider this issue under a plain error analysis. There was a lot of confusion at the district court level. The United States argued that the defendant, on one hand, was very dangerous. On the other hand, they argued that he wasn't dangerous and wouldn't be civilly committed. I point out at JA 231, I argued to the court that there had been a finding of dangerous that St. Elizabeth's concluded. We just don't know the extent of the problems. He had been committed to outpatient treatment. When the district court foreclosed inquiry and directly telegraphed that dangerousness was not a proper consideration, Appellant Dillon was no longer allowed to go into this dangerousness issue and develop it for the record, and therefore there was no further discussion of the civil commitment other than the fact that he had been committed. I believe the tension and the confusion about civil commitment and whether the man is dangerous or whether he is not dangerous is a direct result of the district court's interpretation and the United States' interpretation of Sell as foreclosing an analysis of dangerousness of an individual that makes it to a Sell hearing. I think this is an issue that needs to be addressed. I don't think you can just say Harper deals with the dangerousness and therefore it's done. This is too serious. And Appellant Dillon's case more than adequately demonstrates that because you have an individual that there has been a finding that he is dangerous. There is a finding, and we just were unable to develop the level of it for whatever reason, probably in part because of the confusion in the law. Cell just doesn't tell you where to go from there, but it does tell you that civil commitment is a special consideration, not the end all, but it's a special consideration, and I submit that this is a very important issue that should be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, you are appointed by the court, and the court thanks you for your effective and zealous advocacy.
Thank you.